Hello, and welcome to our third and final episode of our series on CD38-directed strategies in the treatment of multiple myeloma. My name is Dr. Joshua Richter. I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Tisch Cancer Institute, Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and the director of myeloma at the Blavatnik Family Chelsea Medical Center at Mount Sinai. And joining me today is my esteemed colleague and friend, Dr. Andrew Yi. Andrew, please introduce yourself, sir.
Well, thank you, Josh, for the introduction. And I'm Andrew Yi. I focus on multiple myeloma at Mass General Hospital, where I'm the clinical director for the center here. And I'm also an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard. Thank you, Josh. And looking forward to wrapping up our discussion about CD38.
Absolutely. So today we're going to delve into some of the emerging concepts and future directions of CD38-based therapies in the treatment of myeloma. And if you haven't seen our first two episodes, please tune into them to gain some perspectives on the role of CD38-directed therapy, both in the upfront setting of myeloma, as well as the relapse refractory setting. So our learning objectives today in this episode is really going to focus on what's next to come in the realm of CD38-directed therapies. What are some of the new clinical trials and strategies to exploit this concept? How can we ensure that we have a diverse inclusion and equity across the board for getting all of our patients access to these wonderful new therapies? And really, let's start from there. Andrew, please, where do you see CD38 therapies going in the next period of time here?
Right. Yeah, I think it's been amazing to see how CD38 antibody was approved in, I think, in 2015. And it's really just emerged as one of the foundational drugs that we have in myeloma therapy. Because we think about, the three core classes, and CD38 antibodies definitely, earned its chops as one of the core drugs that we have in myeloma therapy. And we've talked before about, newly diagnosed patients, and we talked about in relapse patients, but given how core it is, I can see it being a continual component of the new therapies as they emerge. Because, right now, a lot of the excitement is about, in the past, since 2020, we've had like five drugs which have been approved, targeting BCMA, targeting GPRC5D, and I continue extending on our theme about the dance partner. I think, CD38 antibody will continue to be a great partner with these therapies.
So, yeah, I think to me, you can't talk about myeloma in 2024 without talking about T-cell redirection therapies. And, CAR Ts are really exciting, but to me, I'm a big fan of the bispecific antibodies. They're off the shelf, they're highly effective, and they don't require, a big myeloma institution like yours or mine. They can be given literally anywhere, which means they're available to everyone. And I'm really excited to see some of the combinations of the bispecific antibodies and the CD38s. Do you have any particular insight or preference of combo there?
Right. I mean, so just as just as backdrop, I think just to talk about just to set the stage, we think about CD38 antibodies, but you also think about another core cell surface protein, BCMA, and we think about GPRC, and these are all cell surface proteins. And right now, we have two bispecific antibodies targeting like BCMA just as a starting point, and then we have one bispecific antibody targeting GPRC5D, and they're more in clinical development. And when we think about these myeloma therapies, they get presented as like monotherapy or we just think about as a single agent. But it's sort of how, lenalidomide or bortezomib is kind of presented as a single agent. Okay, fine, it's combined with dexamethasone. But the reality is, as we've talked about and bantered about, is that these are all given in combination. So I think to really unlock the potential of these drugs, it's really going to be given, in combination. So I think about, CD38 antibodies, CD38 is not just on plasma cells, but it's also on other parts of the immune environment. And I think there is a preclinical basis where you target CD38, you could potentially, change the immune system to help augment the activity of these bispecific antibodies, which target, BCMA and which target GPRC5D. So I think about, there's emerging data with, you know, Josh, you might be a little bit closer to this, but I think about the data, which looks at, you know, daratumumab combined with teclistamab, the the BCMA antibody. We think about daratumumab, which targets with talquetamab. And I think you see some amazing responses, especially, and these are patients that, including patients that are CD38 antibody refractory. And I think there's an element where the CD30 antibody can help augment the activity of this. Now, I think in the previous podcast, I said you can combine CD30 antibody with everything more or less, but just one point of caution, would be, we think about BCMA therapy. It can be immunosuppressive and you can have increased risk for infection with hypogammaglobulinemia as being intrinsic to BCMA therapy. So I think you just have to be more thoughtful about when you combine CD30 antibody combined with BCMA therapy, because it's potential that you could have increased immunosuppression risk of infection. But again, the fact that there can be some synergy in terms of augmenting anti-myeloma activity is really promising. And I think when you think about other partners like GPRC5D, there's less risk of immunosuppression with GPRC5 just by nature of where it's expressed. When we think about BCMA, it's on plasma cells, but it's on upstream other immune cells, whereas GPRC5D is more on plasma. So I think the risk of immunosuppression is not as much. So I think, just in clinical trials, you can see some amazing synergies when you combine. So I think, you know, CD30 antibody, you know, is going to be a part of that. And so that's one aspect of it. And then, you know, the ongoing clinical trials, looking at, right, people, you know, we hear about, you know, teclistamab and in as a single agent and four, and we think about and talquetamab and we think about elranatamab and, you know, four prior lines of therapy, right? That's where it's approved. But guess it's being looked at in earlier lines. It's being looked at in 1 to 3 prior lines. And that's with teclistamab and talquetamab and, you know, they're all being looked at early lines. And a lot of the combinations are with CD38 antibody. Mm-hmm. And so that data is ongoing. These are phase 3 studies, and so I think I'm really excited to see how these will read out. Moreover, we also have it in newly diagnosed patients too, right? We're all excited about CD38 antibody in newly diagnosed patients, but I think BCMA, I think we're going to see combinations looking at, you know, targeting BCMA up front in newly diagnosed patients, and these are involved in combinations with CD38 antibody. So again, it just speaks to kind of the primacy of CD38 targeting CD38.
Absolutely. So a lot to unpack. So
I guess we just kept talking, right?
No, so we look at the monotherapy of the bispecifics. Most of them have response rates around 60-70%. When you know, we look at some of the TRIM data, looking at the combos with CD38s, we get some of those early studies over 90%. But to your point exactly, some of our physician scientists at our institution looked at responses to COVID vaccination. And the two biggest predictors of inability to mount an effective COVID antibody response were BCMA-based therapy and CD38-based therapy. So I think your word of caution needs to be stated again, because it's one of the most important things. These are both highly effective therapies, but the immune suppression is notable. And to me, I actually think a better combination of CD38 is with talquetamab, the GPRC5D bispecific, and there's other GPRC5D bispecifics like forimtamig. And one of the things we see there, exactly as you pointed out, is that the talquetamab drug and the other GPRC5D bispecifics don't deplete the CD19 positive B cell population, which is probably one of the main reasons why the infectious complications are less. You actually can get immunoglobulin recovery while on GPRC5D, as opposed to the BCMA backbones, which really lead to persistent hypogammaglobulinemia. So I agree. I think CD38 plus bispecific is great. I think that I would prefer the GPRC5D along with the CD38. And to your point, I think with all of the T-cell redirection therapies, we may be looking even farther away from needing autologous transplant, and some wonderful studies about using bispecifics plus CD38s early on. Really, really exciting data.
Yeah. Right. I think just from seeing some of the clinical, I mean, again, amazing, exceptional responses. And I think we're still kind of in like the alpha stage of using these drugs, right? You know, we're maybe version 0.9, you know, in terms of it, because I bet, you know, as we get more experience using it, I think we can better address the risk of the, you know, in terms of the dose. I think, again, it's all about the frequency and the schedule that which can really help, you know, think about how can we optimize that to help minimize some of these potential complications, you know, infectious complications, as well as maximizing the responses. Because I think once you do have a response, these responses are, you know, they're like amazingly durable. So that's why I think, you know, we're all really, like, really excited to see the randomized data, see how this plays out.
So love to hear your thoughts about some of the other CD38 combos with some of the up and coming cell mods. What are your thoughts about some of that data?
Right. So right now we were talking about, you know, lenalidomide, pomalidomide. These are kind of established, you know, immunomodulatory drugs. But the next exciting development in terms of that class of drugs is like thinking about drugs like iberdomide and mezigdomide, right? So I think the next phase is, you know, when you think about like lenalidomide and pomalidomide, those drugs were not focused. They weren't developed for myeloma. Those were sort of accidentally developed, focusing on TNF alpha inhibition, and we just kind of accidentally walked into the fact that these are amazing drugs in myeloma. But now that we know that the mechanism, it's sort of how like all these drugs that we use, like, you know, like Ozempic, et cetera, they're all being repurposed for other uses, right? But I think about now that we know that, you know, it's about cereblon, Ikaros, and Ilos degradation, I think that, you know, the iberdomide and mezigdomide can be the next big potential wave of myeloma therapeutics. So those are specifically designed to leverage off of that knowledge. And so these are, you know, these have more activity than lenalidomide, pomalidomide. And, you know, some of the emerging data with combining with the CD3 antibody looks really promising. And I think it's just, you know, there is a part of me that says, like, why not combine them, right? There's a little bit of there's a little bit of empiricism in this as well. And again, I think things to be mindful of is that when you combine, you know, we were just talking about pomalidomide and how, you know, there is a little bit more neutropenia when you do a CD3 antibody combined with pomalidomide, for example. I think that probably does play a role when you combine, you know, CD30 antibodies with, you know, the newer cell mods. Is probably have to pay attention to the myelosuppression. But again, you can have amazing efficacy and, you know, with careful attention to dosing and supportive therapy, I think you can maintain you can have great responses.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think if people have tuned in, not just to this podcast, but, you know, what we talked about in the others, that the research world of myeloma is exploding, and we're having so many options, so many highly efficacious drugs in clinical trials. I can remember when I first started out doing this, you know, we'd have 10 clinical trials open, and if one of them kind of worked, we were excited. Now we have 30 plus trials open with drugs we know already work. But one of the things we really want to make sure of is that myeloma affects a diverse population. And we always want to make sure that we can have all of our patients, regardless of any of the defining factors, we want to make sure everyone has access to these wonderful therapies. So a bit of a tough question, but I want to throw it to you first. Any thoughts about how to optimize diversity, equity, and inclusion in getting some of these amazing new therapeutic options to the widest array of patients possible?
Right. I think it's fundamental that we see we have to see how these drugs work across as broad a range of patients as possible, not just narrowly restricted to one group of patients. And I think in this way, you can better understand, you know, the efficacy of these drugs and where, you know, and potential side effects, right? In terms of, if we only look at it in a certain population, we don't know about the potential range of adverse events. So in terms of like thinking about the dosing, thinking about potential side effects, we don't know about until we evaluate as diverse range of patients as possible. And so I think it's really key to have that, you know, in our clinical trials, especially, you know, in terms of when we think about, you know, multiple myeloma, it tends to be more common in patients with African ancestry. That's not something that's fully appreciated. And that's something that I think the multiple myeloma trial community is trying to actively address, is how can we make sure that the trial population, that the patients in our clinical trials reflects like the population this disease affects. And, you know, some things that I think about would be, you know, just the support, you know, clinical trials is, it takes a lot of work for a patient to participate in a clinical trial. And in terms of, I think, like simple things would be like, you know, coverage for transportation, you know, support for housing, you know, things that just to help operate, because, you know, it's not, you know, just to help make the logistics of participation as easier as possible. So I think things that, you know, if you can have subsidies or, you know, as financial assistance for like housing, I think that can go a long way, because you don't want that to be the limiting factor, right? You don't want this to just be, you know, only patients who have the resources to participate, to have access to this, you know, amazing therapy, these potentially amazing therapies.
Absolutely. So I think you bring up a great point, is that there are geographic and financial and socioeconomic reasons that may provide barriers. There are a number of ways that we can attack this. So I think one of them is absolutely providing some degree of travel assistance or subsidy or something of that nature to allow patients who may have difficulty traveling to the academic center to receive these clinical trials. The other is utilizing our community oncology colleagues and satellite sites. So not every trial needs to be everything done at the main center. So shared responsibility, where maybe for a bispecific or CAR T, we give the initial phase at the main hub that has more resource-rich facilities, and then partner with our community colleagues to continue long-term care, and the consideration of using centralized CROs and data gathering to allow the trials to spread out more than just at the main hub can be a real way to expand access across multiple patients. The other something you brought up, which is a major issue, is that we certainly notice a higher incidence of multiple myeloma and related disorders in patients of African and African American descent. Now, we do know, and we've also talked about in this series, the profound nature of cytopenia, specifically neutropenia, that we see. Now, we do know that patients of African and African American descent can actually have lower normal range of white blood count than patients of Asian or Caucasian descent. Now, this actually used to be called benign ethnic neutropenia. That term has gone by the wayside now that we found a genomic underpinning for this. And now we call this the Duffy null status. So we have started to incorporate Duffy null status testing for our patients. And in the next generation of clinical trials for myeloma, where in the inclusion exclusion criteria, it may say, if you have an ANC, an absolute neutrophil count below 1000, you're not eligible. The next generation of trials will actually have additional criteria for patients who are Duffy null status that may still have no increased risk of infection, but may have ANCs down into the 800, 700, or even 500 range. So I think there's a broad range of approaches we can do to ensure that we can provide all of these great therapies with, you know, the singular focus of cure, make sure that everyone has equal access as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Duffy part's critical, because you don't want to just set. I get a lot of this is about individualizing the patients. And I think, in terms of being able to enhance your eligibility with that in mind, I think is critical.
Absolutely. And with our final few moments, and I know this is a large kind of thing to unwrap in only a short period of time, is it's one of the biggest hot buttons in myeloma. I would love to get your take on MRD. Minimal residual disease testing. How do you currently utilize it in your practice? And again, you're going to have to take, you know, all this data and your practice and cram it into a short amount of time.
Right. You know, I think the MRD, it's a whole other big topic discussion. I think, you know, one thing, a lot of what we've been talking about in these podcasts is about adding therapies, doublets, triplets, quadruplets, adding this, trying that. But I think there's going to be a next wave of myeloma therapy is to figure out, how can we de-escalate therapy? How can we identify patients where you can actually put a pause in the therapy? Maybe some patients are cured that we just don't even know about. And so I think the MRD testing may be an important tool to better identify patients where you can kind of, you know, pause therapy rather than just keep adding more therapy. And one of, I think, potentially exciting developments with MRD testing right? Again, MRD test is just looking for, it's just, when I think about, it's just looking more about a sensitive test for underlying disease, right? And right now requires, you know, conventionally we think about requiring a bone marrow biopsy to look at, you know, for one times, you know, 10 to the minus 6 level cells. But I think the next phase in MRD testing really would be like peripheral blood MRD. And I think, you know, I remember like a few years ago, that's kind of more just talked about, but now we actually have a couple commercial laboratories that are up and running that where you can do peripheral blood MRD testing. And the results of that potentially even rival the traditional bone marrow and next generation sequencing based results. And so, you know, I think for me, one of the main limitations to doing MRD testing was, and for patients, obviously, is that you need a bone marrow biopsy. But if you can actually get the same knowledge from a peripheral blood test, I think that could be a game changer. And I think right now we have this tool, but we don't really have the data to better figure out how to actually best use this tool to better figure out, you know, which patients can de-escalate therapy. I know like MRD testing is one of the things, for example, in the Perseus study that we started off, that I kind of briefly mentioned in the first podcast. And, you know, in there, they use patients who are MRD negative after 2 years. I think the option is to discontinue daratumumab, for example, in the study. But I mean, that can be broader than that. It can be maybe discontinue all therapy, right? And so it's A is the test. A is the data to support use the test. And also, you know, what is it? Is MRD just one time point? It might be, you might need sustained MRD. Maybe you need to couple it with imaging. So there are multiple layers of this. But I think it's going to be exciting to be able to figure out, okay, you know what? You know, you can, you know, Mrs. Jones, you can come off therapy. I think patients would love to have that opportunity.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is one of the successes of modern day myeloma therapy and myeloma research. You know you're doing better in a cancer where there's focus on de-escalation. I think we've seen this in Hodgkin's disease, germ cell tumors, and a number of other cancers where most cancers are solely focused on, we need to improve because the outcomes are poor. When you get to a point where how can we back off, that's a good sign that you're making good headway. Because I completely agree with you. At the end of the day, we just want Goldilocks. We don't want the porridge too cold where the patient progresses, but we also don't want it too hot. And we all have those patients who've been on maintenance therapy for a decade and we're afraid to stop it, but we also don't think they really need it. One of the studies that I'm very anxiously awaiting the readout is the SWOG 1803 dramatic study being run by Amrita Krishnan, where she's doing exactly what you talked about, which is looking, she's looking at Rev versus Dara-Rev in the maintenance setting with MRD stopping rules along the way. And like you said, it may be that this data matures and we know, okay, if you're on Revlimid and your standard risk and you achieve sustained MRD negativity, maybe that patient does just the same with or without continued Revlimid. And ultimately, we can get similar outcomes, but better tolerability, fewer perhaps secondary malignancies, obviously a cost savings of not having to give continual therapy. So I think MRD is a really wonderful tool to figure out, do we need to do more or do we need to do less? I, for one, use it as part of a discussion point pre-transplant. So I think we're starting to learn from a number of trials like the IFM 2009 that, you know, if you get MRD negative with induction, you know, you may do in some scenarios just as well with or without a transplant. So, you know, I think for me, if I have a patient that has high risk and doesn't get a great remission and they're agreeing for a transplant, I push forward with transplant. A patient tells me, you know what, I don't want a transplant. I don't force it on anyone. But we have patients where they want to make the most informed decision of the risks and the benefits. And for those patients, you know, we often do a bone marrow biopsy and have a discussion that Dara-RVD is so good that if you get MRD negative, maybe you don't need a transplant. But if you get a quad like that and you don't get rid of all the disease, you're someone who may need a different modality like high-dose melphalan to really get that better outcome. Are there any other clinical scenarios that you're using it in the clinic today?
No, I think you kind of covered the key areas where it's being used, you know, in terms of discontinuation of therapy versus escalation of therapy. And another big black unknown area is like, you know, patients who are on maintenance therapy? Do you escalate therapy if they go from like MRD negative to MRD positive, right? Right now, that's sort of a big uncharted territory as well. And, you know, I think there's going to be, you know, there's the Eureka study that looked at, you know, looking at escalation of therapy after like CD30 antibody, daratumumab plus lenalidomide versus lenalidomide after initial therapy. So that, I mean, that's a big uncharted territory too, where we're really looking for more clinical trial data.
Absolutely. So just like we did in the last two trials, the last two podcasts, you have a hem-onc doc that they're about to leave for the day. You have a few minutes with them to share your immense Ivy League wisdom. What are the couple of main points that you would want to get across about the future of CD38 directed therapy in myeloma?
Right. I think the future, you know, I think the horizon is so broad and the future is so promising. And I think about how, you know, the way we're using CD30 antibodies, it's going to change in the future. And the way it's going to change in the future is thinking about the available dance partners that it has in terms of thinking about bispecific antibodies, thinking about, you know, with CELMoDs, maybe with a BCL2 inhibitor. And, you know, and you can think about these different strategies, you know, that can emerge based on these combinations. I think it's just a rapidly changing field. And I think it's just so exciting to be, you know, I feel fortunate to be, you know, we're living this right now. We can see all these rapid developments. So I do feel really, you know, excited about, and so that's why I feel excited talking about this. But thanks. Thank you, Josh.
Absolutely. So I couldn't agree more. That nothing, you know, I used to say when we started off treating myeloma, I used to tell people it's not a curable disease. Now there are a handful of patients that we are curing, for lack of a better term, by accident. We give them the therapy and it turns out we actually cured them. And the future is curing more and eventually everyone deliberately. And the answer in a disease that's subclonal at its level is multiple mechanisms of action, exactly as you talked about. It gets approved monotherapy, but the combinations are where it's at. And with the efficacy and tolerability profile of CD38s, they're going to be part of it, either combinations with bispecifics or trispecifics, consolidation after CAR T, induction prior to CAR T. They're certainly going to be part of the puzzle we need to put together to find the secret sauce for everyone. And with that, I would really like to thank everyone for joining us for this exploration of emerging concepts and future directions of CD38 targeting therapies and multiple myeloma. We really hope that you found this information informative and insightful. If you have any questions about the content or information that we've talked about today, simply scan the QR code on the screen and submit your questions. All questions will be answered in a series of e-newsletters following the podcast series. And please don't forget to complete the continuing education evaluation to claim your CE credit. Also, be sure to download the reference resource associated with this podcast. Finally, if you've missed any of the previous episodes that are amazing with Dr. Yi and myself, please be sure to check them out for a complete picture of CD38 targeting strategies in multiple myeloma. And on behalf of Dr. Andrew Yi and myself, thank you so much for tuning in and be well.